Oh, hello there, gentle viewers. You caught me catching up on an old favorite. It's wonderful to get lost in a story, isn't it? Adventure, heroics, and discovery. Don't they just take you away? Come with me now, if you will, gentle viewers. Join me on a new voyage of the mind. A little tale I like to call Jim Hill, Slayer of the Vampires. How's it going, Jim?
Wow.
Do you know what that's from? Do you know what that's from?
I have no clue, but I think I better add that to my resume. Always nice to have another skill to fall back on. So.
It's the introduction of Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, Season 7, Episode 16, the Storyteller episode.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. I should know that.
So. I was thinking last night, you know, trying to come up with an introduction for the show, and Laurel and I were goofing around talking about, you know, series that we'd watched end to end, and Buffy was the first one that we'd never watched together end to end. She'd seen it before, and I never had. So, did you ever see Buffy?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh my god, the middle three seasons where Joss Whedon just decided he hated Buffy and wanted her to be miserable, like seasons 5, 6, and most of 7.
It does get a little dark, you know, and the irony is during this exact same period he's trying to get the Buffy the animated series up out of the ground. So it's like, really,
yeah.
Really?
Oh my god, so depressing. Anyway, but that was one of the. One of the funnier episodes in season 7. That and Once More With Feeling. Did you ever see the episode where they sang everything?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
genius.
Yep.
Anyway, Jim. Mm-hmm. So big news in the last week was that the Backlot Tour is being closed in just a couple of days. By the time this episode gets out, it'll be within a couple of days. End of the month at the studios, which brings to 3... the number of attractions that have closed recently in the studios. And I got to say, Jim, they're taking up a lot of space. But let's go through them real quick. Number one, Backlot Tour, which is taking up a ton of space in the studios. Number two, the American Idol Experience, which was right there at the center of the park. And number three, the American Film Institute Showcase, which was the thing that you walked through at the end of the old Backlot Tour, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, that they had, in theory, a changing series of displays that, again, the American Film Institute collaborated with Disney to pull together. Though, again, toward the end, it just, it's like, that exhibit that's been there for 2 years, leave it.
They were showing costumes from, like, Shakespeare in Love or something.
It was
That was a lovely film, but it's about as old as Shakespeare himself. So the interesting thing, Jim, you know, if you think about the real estate that's available, you've got from American Idol all the way over to essentially Sounds Dangerous, which they're kind of using in some spaces for the Jedi Training Academy sign-up, right?
Yep.
But then you've got, you know, if you go back from Sounds Dangerous to the back of the park, you've got all that backlot tour space available. What's going on there?
Well, I to be blunt, this is Disney's Hollywood Studios waving the white flag. Okay. Not so much because of Universal Studios Florida, which thanks to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter Diagon Alley having been obviously so enthusiastically being embraced by Central Florida tourists and having had an amazing summer. No, this is just the Imagineers finally willing to admit the obvious, that Disney's Hollywood Studios is never, ever going to be a really for real film and production facility, that it's now time to let go of that dream and just turn Disney's studios into a full-blown theme park, which the way I hear it involves a rebranding.
Really?
I know we've only just really taken on this new name, Disney's Hollywood Studios.
Go ahead, sorry.
The new one.
Wait, there's a new. The ink isn't dry on the new stationery, Jim.
Well, evidently the new name is going to be Disney's Hollywood Adventure, much in the style of Disney's California Adventure. And they feel that this is appropriate given that the two brands and IPs, intellectual properties that are basically going to anchor this new vision to the park are actually two things that George Lucas personally helped get up out of the ground. One is Lucasfilm, and the other is Pixar Animation Studios. And it's just kind of in a weird way sad because, you know, back in the 1980s when the cost of things and of producing movies in Hollywood were spinning out of control. I mean, oh my God, $30 million to make Ghostbusters.
It's crazy.
Nutty money. They were looking for a low cost alternative and it looked like Orlando was going to be that place. And, and for a time it really did seem like it was going to work. They built Residential Street and they built New York Street and these are beautiful, nice sets.
Yeah.
But in the end, the noise from things like Catastrophe Canyon and the special effects tank basically made this place useless to film production companies. I guess that's the weird thing is that the thing that's closing now, the tram tour, is in a way the thing that prevented this becoming a real movie studio. And I don't know. I guess for me, I've been tracking this thing since they announced it back in March of 1986. It was big news then that Disney was going to do this third attraction at Walt Disney World. And at the time, they stressed this was going to be a working movie studio that would give people a glimpse of how films, animated features, and TV shows were made. Mm-hmm. But again, important thing to stress here. This was originally called the Disney MGM Studio Tour, not the Disney MGM Studio Theme Park. And the other thing, I know you'll find this fascinating, but when Dick Nunes is announcing this, again in March of 1986, he makes a point of telling the reporters at the Orlando Sentinel that the studio tour, because it's really not going to be all that big, they won't charge as much for admission as they do for the Magic Kingdom and Epcot, which at that time, again, to give you some reference here, a one-day ticket to the park in 86 was $18.
And, the studios, because it's a smaller park, they won't charge as much as the $18.
See, he puts that out there, and by the time they open 3 years later, that's gone, all right?
Technically true now.
Very true now. Yeah. And now, look, there's a lot of stories about Disney rushing to get into the studio tour business, because Michael Eisner, the new MCA, the company that actually owned Universal at that point, was getting serious about their East Coast park. I mean, they'd announced they were going to do an East Coast version of the Universal Tour.
Yeah.
As far back as 1981. And again, look, there's a lot of truth to that story. Eisner was a very competitive guy, but there's a part of the story that people always overlook. And that's when Eisner came on board, as head of Disney Studio in September of 1984. In fact, what's kind of weird, Lynn, is that his first day, the day they announced he was coming on board, September 22nd. We're recording this on the 24th. So literally this Monday was the 30th anniversary of Eisner walking through the door and taking this sleepy company. I mean, let's be clear. He worked with Frank Wells. He worked with Jeffrey Katzenberg. But they took that sleepy company and turned it into this global powerhouse.
Yeah.
But at that time, I mean, there were only 8 studios in the business, and Disney was 8. They were dead last. They had tiny market share. And so the whole point of these guys bringing Eisner, Wells, and Katzenberg in, it was like, as far as the board was concerned, job number one was to increase Disney's market share.
And they had nowhere to go but up.
Well, that's it exactly. I mean, at that time, Disney was only shooting 3 new movies a year. And so, the way, obviously, to turn that around is that they wanted to change Disney from a company that did 3 movies a year to a studio that made 10, maybe even 15 movies a year.
Wow.
But here's the thing, that Walt Disney Studios, at that time anyway, just didn't have the physical resources to do this. I mean, on the 51-acre lot in Burbank... Well, all right. To put this in perspective, Eisner used to, before he came to Disney, Eisner worked at Paramount. They have a 65-acre lot. They had 25 sound stages. So, they could handle that sort of ambitious production schedule. Whereas Disney, had four sound stages. All right. And given that the newest sound stage, stage number three, had been built back in 1954 for 20,000 leagues.
Wow.
I mean, everything's out of date.
Yeah.
Okay. So Eisner, you know, that's again, time to jump up our production. And, I've got out of date equipment. It's expensive to shoot movies in California. Meanwhile, in Florida, at that point, the company owned 28,000 acres. And again, Florida's a right to work state. So that means you can shoot a movie there, and not have to deal with a lot of the encumbrances that come from the Teamsters, the unions, the guilds. So you can get a movie made in Florida for half to two thirds of what it would cost to shoot in Hollywood.
Labor's the biggest component of the, of a movie, right?
That's it, exactly. Yeah, okay. And here's the other thing. When Eisner flies down to, does his first familiarization trip to Florida, and he's touring the Disney, theme parks, he can't help but think that, look at the Magic Kingdom. Look at Epcot. They're backlots. Look at all the scenery. We should be using this.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that Disney hadn't done this before. There was actually one movie that was actually shot on Disney property back in 1976. The Treasure of Mantuba. It's a thing with Peter Ustinov, Robert Foxworthy, and Vic Morrow. And they actually shot out on Discovery Island.
I was going to say Discovery Island, yeah.
Yeah, that's evidently there was a shipwreck scene, and so it's like, hey, we got a wrecked ship, put them there. But beyond that, the only time Disney
ever... still there, Jim.
Yes, but we don't swim out after dark and go look at them, Len.
We're
principled people, in theory. anyway, the only time Disney shot stuff in Florida was TV specials that talked up the resort themselves, and usually they were sponsored by Kraft's Food. So just very cheesy productions. So Eisner, that's it. We're going to use Disney World. So I don't know if you've ever seen that cinematic masterpiece, Ernest Saves Christmas.
It is Jim Varney's magnum opus.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I love a Christmas movie that includes the phrase, nobody moves, nobody dies.
Like Bruce at the holidays, like the thrill of murder.
Anyway, that was the first movie in the Eisner era to be shot on property. In fact, there's...
that's the answer to a trivia question somewhere. They're going to be in a bar one night.
There you go.
And they're going to be like, you know what it is? But people will be like,
it's honestly a fascinating movie to watch now because it's such a time capsule of what Walt Disney World was like at the time. For example, there's this scene in the movie where Ernest is supposedly out on a highway, and a car in front of him has a Christmas tree on its roof, and it falls off in traffic, and Ernest pulls over and rushes in the traffic to save this. They actually shot this on Epcot Center Drive. So, if you're enough of a Disney dweeb, it's like, I know the back of that sign. Likewise, there's this scene where Ernest is pretending to be this backwoodsman, and he's delivering a pickup truck full of snakes to a movie studio.
Sure.
And what's great about this scene is it's actually shot. I mean, they're shooting at the construction site of the studio. I mean, this is 1988. So, there's very little done. In fact, I think all they had done at this point was the guard shack. So as you look in the background, it's like that's supposed to be a soundstage, which is mostly structural steel. But they finished bits and pieces to try to make the movie happen. In fact, the first house that was completed on Residential Street was Vern's house, and so you have Ernest delivering the Christmas tree that he saved to Vern's house. But it was kind of the same thing with the first TV movie that was shot there, which was Splash 2, if you can believe it.
There was a Splash 2?
Oh, God, yes.
Was Daryl in it?
No, actually, Amy Yazbek from Wings took over as Madison. And it was,
Is that what she did after Wings?
Well, this was pre-Wings,
this was her break before Wings? Whatever happened to her?
Well, she's actually spent a lot of the last couple of years in court. She was Mrs. John Ritter when, oddly enough, he died on the Disney lot in production of when they were shooting the Eight Reasons or to Date My Daughter or something to that effect. And she's all
She's married to John Ritter. Really?
She was married to John Ritter, and there was actually a pretty ugly court case because she believed that if Disney – I mean, face it, Disney is right next door to St. Joseph's Hospital, and they were shooting this sitcom on the Disney lot. And, you know, he had a torn aorta. And Amy actually believed that if Disney had moved quickly and gotten John across the street, they could have saved him. And in the end, after, you know, very expensive, very ugly court case, the judge basically decided that, you know, Disney had done everything in good faith. And nobody knew, given John's symptoms at the time, they thought it was, you know, severe indigestion or something like that. I mean, when you have a torn aorta, the symptoms are very weird.
Yeah.
And but anyway, I mean, she played Madison in this thing. So, for example, when they shot the scenes of Madison frolicking with dolphins, it's actually them shooting inside of the big tank at the Living Seas. And likewise, when you finally get to see, you know, the Alan Bauer and the Madison character who both are living in a desert island together happily. Again, Discovery Island. So, but yeah, it just, I you know, it just, they tried to get things going relatively quickly. In fact, they took on not just Disney produced shows, but stuff that were other companies that were looking to shoot in Florida. I mean, for, what's the name of the family? Ilya Silkin, the folks who did the Superman movies, wanted to do a television series. So they did Superboy. And
Superboy.
That was first weekly series to be shot at Disney MGM. And this is where it gets kind of strange, Lynn, because again, they start shooting in August of 1988. By the time the studio actually opens and the first guests are coming in to see movies being shot, looking forward, I mean, that's the hype. You're going to come and see movies and television shows and animated films being made. By the time the first guests are coming in, Superboy has decamped and gone down the street to Universal, mostly because Disney had built three sound stages and managed to fill them immediately.
Wow.
And it was – so it was one of these things where they were trying to persuade the Superboy people, like, we really need the 15,000-square-foot stage you shoot in because we're trying to lure a major motion picture down here. So could you go share a sound stage with the Mickey Mouse Club? And they're like, no. You know, we need a really for real sound stage. So they got out of the street to Universal. And Universal had built – four sound stages, three that were 16,500 square feet, and another monster of a sound stage, it was 22,000 square feet. And meanwhile, there's two other facilities that they're actually building for Nickelodeon. So, you know, Universal had a lot more inventory to offer. More to the point, they didn't pretend, you know, they were, you know, in fact, Jay Stein, the gentleman who was in charge of the head of recreation for MCA, the parent company of the Universal Studio theme park. I mean, he was very straightforward about, look, we're not a theme park. This is a production facility with rides in it. So I swear to God, Glenn, I got this story like a week ago.
Really?
For the first 10 days that Universal Studio was open, no area music.
Really? You just walked around?
You walked around and dead silent because, again, this is where movies are being shot.
And they didn't want the distraction.
And what was funny is that for a while there, it's like they're like, Jay, we need something. I mean, it just seems weird that people are walking through these empty areas. And it's like, okay, put on sound effects. So it's like you'd walk through New York and you'd hear like bacon sizzling. You know, in the tenements above you. Or, you know, you
it just sounds bizarre.
It does. And it just, you know, Hollywood Boulevard.
The sounds of bones breaking in the back, craps game in the alley.
Yeah, and it's just, it was one of these things where eventually 10 days in, it's like, Jay's like, all right, fine, you're going to have your background music, you know. But yeah, that they were that much more serious about it being a working facility. You know, whereas Disney really couldn't ever get a handle on what are we building? You know, are we in fact building a production facility? Because, you know, as they began to poll people going to Walt Disney World about, you know, they were like, oh, I want to go to that studio, and what sort of rides is it going to have, and this sort of thing. And they began to realize, oh, crap, people, you know, they're going to compare it to Magic Kingdom. They're going to compare right. it to Epcot.
Just proximity.
Yeah. So it's just sort of like, all right, we got to fold in more shows. We got to fold in, you know, more entertainment. And meanwhile, here are the production companies that are coming down, and they're looking at these wonderful, brand-new, state-of-the-art sound stages that Disney may have made, and they're like, well, what's that up there? It's like, oh, well, that's the glassed-in tour corridor, and that, you know, you're going to have 200 to 300 people looking down at you at any one time to see what you're doing. And it's like, oh, no, 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 that's not going to work. You know,
What was the objection there? They just didn't want the creative process? They didn't want people... Directors don't want people looking over their shoulder. What?
You know, it's one of these things where it's like, you know, the conversation I always heard is like, do we really want 200, you know, 200 to 300 people taking pictures of Teamsters scratching their ass? You know, which again made no sense to me because again, Florida is a right to work state, but it'd just be
guys off the street.
Guys off the street scratching their ass. But. It was one of these things that for filmmakers who, you know, just I feel like this is a craft to have a crowd looking down on you and judging you the whole time. It just didn't seem, you know, it was a deal breaker.
Tough to work with somebody looking over your shoulder, right?
Yeah. So here's the weird thing that in April of 1990, Disney sort of sneaks the information that they're going to build 4 new sound stages. And interesting thing about these sound stages, not inside of the footprint of Disney MGM. In fact, they were going to be built on the other side of World Drive, pretty much in the same spot that the Coronado currently occupies.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
And, you know, same thing. They were going to be shooting for the same sort of the same size, the giant stages that Universal had built. You know, I think that the smallest was actually going to be 22,000 square feet. So you could get a big movie in there. But more to the point, you're just telling, look, you have the exact same thing you got with the sound stages inside the park. But you don't have tourists looking at you. You don't have people judging you. And in the end, because Disney noticed that even as they were announcing this in 1990, that, you know, it just things began to dry up, that the people came to Florida, tried it. You know, I mean, like, for example, Ron Howard came down and shot his movie Parenthood at Universal. But people would go back to L.A. and go, look, they're nice facilities. It's very nice, but it's hot. You know, it's blazingly hot down there. More to the point, all of the money that the studios thought they would save by going to Florida got eaten up by having to fly people back and forth from L.A.
L.A., yeah.
You know.
And who wants to be all the way across the country from their families when they can drive home at night?
That's it, exactly. That's it, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, at the same time, you know, remember that when MGM first opened up, people complained that it was a half-day park and that they wanted – you know, more rides. So, you know, one of the first things Disney does is plot out Sunset Boulevard and, you know, and think about it. You put in Tower of Terror, you know, opening in 94 and, you know, every, what is it? Every 30, 45 seconds, another elevator full of people is going, ah!
Yeah.
Again, you've got more noise bleed into the park. You've got, you know, you've got Indiana Jones, you know, doing 3, 4, 5 shows a day and all of the noise, you know, associated with that. It just, and meanwhile, you know, your original vision for the tram tour, where, I mean, back in the day, I mean, you got on that tram by the magic of Disney Animation, and then you rolled out and did Catastrophe Canyon, which again made a lot of noise, and then you got dropped off at the Acme warehouse, and sort of you were trapped there. I mean, you could go over to the you know, the cafe there and get some food. But the understanding was that you were caught here, and the only way you could get back to where you'd left your stroller or get back into the park is you had to take the walking tour. And that was 45 minutes of, again, you're in those corridors looking down, in a lot of cases, at empty sound stages because nobody wanted to make movies or television here. So, you know, the only entertainment you had was The Lottery, which was a film that Gary Marshall had actually shot at Disney with Bette Midler on the New York the back lot. In fact, I was talking with Lisa Girolami. She's a veteran Imagineering producer, and that was her first project for Imagineering. She's, in fact, just in this past year, she's the one who handled the new wonderful digital explosion effect that closes out Big Thunder for Disneyland, and she also had a hand in getting all of the new wonderful digital footage that was just put in Dallas and Wonderland. But this was Lisa's first gig, really on that side of the company, working with Imagineering. But that, again, was all you got to see, were these films of people talking about how movies are made, and you kept looking into these empty rooms where supposedly you were going to be watching things being made. But, you know, in the end, nobody really wanted to go make stuff there. I mean, there were a few things. HBO did their miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and NBC brought a revival of Let's Make a Deal there. But all of these shows kind of just faded out after a while, and Disney ended up with all these empty buildings, which is, you know, why you saw things like Toy Story Mania get loaded into, you know, that soundstage back in 2008. It just, you had empty buildings. You were walking by buildings that things were supposed to be in. And so, again, just to go back to what we said at the start here, this is Disney just sort of, you know, okay, it's time to let go of that dream. And more to the point, it's time to turn this into a full-blown theme park. So when you look at the tram tour and, you know, the environs around, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, because at least for the foreseeable future, Lights, Motor, Action will remain up and running. But there's a lot happening around that facility.
Around Lights, Motor, Action.
Lights, Motor, Action.
Okay. That's a ton of real estate right there.
It is a ton of real estate. And I think the way that people need to start thinking about the back of the park, the back of, and again, our rebranded Disney's Hollywood Adventure. This is going to be the new Fantasyland. This is going to be the studio's equivalent. You're going to see a lot of Pixar-themed C&D tickets. If you want a sense of what Disney's going to do, go check out Toy Story Land.
I knew you were going to say that, Disneyland Paris.
For Disneyland Paris and Hong Kong Disneyland.
These are basic spinner rides. These are,
well, but at the same time, understand that they're not shutting down the tram tour because, you know, that's all spinner rides. So, you know, this is going to be a basically Pixar land back here. And among the things you are going to see is Cars Land Light. You're going to get
it's one attraction and two spinner rides.
You got to remember that Cars Land, the Radiator Springs Racers for Cars Land is an e-ticket plus. All right. I mean, let's not gild the lily here. It is the same ride technology as Test Track at Epcot.
Yeah.
But it's a much more family-friendly take on this. But they're looking to do it all inside of one giant building, because obviously if you do this sort of thing outdoors in Florida with the rain, as anybody who's been on Test Track, when they come out the back door and there's a rainstorm going on,
yeah,
you know, you get the crap beaten out of you. So,
yeah.
But it's that. My understanding is you're going to see Cars Land, Radio Springs Racers. They're also bringing Flo's, the diner, because they're going to need a food component back there.
Yeah.
Then you're looking at sort of extending out from Toy Story Mania. You'll see a couple of spinners go back. Just look at look what they've done in Paris and look what they've done in Hong Kong, and you're going to see a couple of iterations of those sorts of things. Meanwhile, to the front of the park, I mean, we've talked about this before. That is still Star Wars land. In fact, it's been kind of interesting to watch how things continue to slip and slide around there. You know, it's, I think in a lot of ways what happened this past summer with, and we're not just talking about Diagon Alley, we're talking about what happened at that theme park with the Frozen Summer Fun promotion. They saw what would happen if you put IP in that park that people really liked and were really excited about.
So they're keeping the, I mean, it looks like the Frozen Sing-Along is going to be a permanent addition. I mean, if
we're back in Voyage of the Little Mermaid country. You know, I mean, remember that show?
That show was like we're just going to do this for the summer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it initially when it came online in 89 was 18 months. You know, just the whole notion of, you know, that's the, and, you know, again, we are decades past its, you know, sell-by date, but, you know, people love Ariel and, you know, that show is staying. Even with, you know, the Little Mermaid right over in New Fantasyland. Where this gets a little strange is I don't know if you've heard about the plan for Sunset Boulevard for the Beauty and the Beast live show.
No.
There has been talk for about 2 and 3 years about a Tangled show going in there, and I'm having a little trouble right now because just in the past week or so, in fact, it was Bradley over at Stitch Kingdom that tripped over this, but there's an audition, series of auditions that are being held this month for a new show on the Disney Cruise Line.
Yeah,
that
Tangled for May, yeah.
Will be Tangled.
Yeah.
Now, just because Tangled is going on the boats doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going into the park. You may remember there was actually that announcement of how the Toy Story show that was actually on the boats was originally going to be replacing Aladdin, the musical spectacular. At DCA.
But then there was a huge backlash over that.
Well, I think in the end it was people looked at the musical version, the Toy Story musical, and thought, you know, it's really not good enough to put into a theater that big. It's just when you're on a cruise ship and it's just sort of like, what are we doing tonight? Okay, we're going to go see that.
Yeah.
You know, it's
true. You can do smaller, less ambitious things on a cruise ship, and people will allow for the smaller ambition because of the fact that you're on the ship.
Yeah. So conversely, though, I've been talking to a bunch of folks who seem to think that because the Tangled thing for some reason stalled out while they were getting it ready to bring into the studios. And then the thinking now is that this is kind of the inversion of what was going to happen with the Toy Story musical. That it'll go on the boats, and it's got a wonderful, solid Alan Menken score. Go on the boats, be popular, and they can use the popularity of the show on the boats as the excuse to finally bring it into the park and finally replace Beauty and the Beast. But just understand the timetable on that would be 2 years, possibly three, because obviously the show's got to go out, be on the boats, people get excited about it, and then you know, turn the key on that. And meanwhile, you know, you've got Frozen, you know, the for the first time in forever, you know, sing-alongs, just doing tremendous business.
Yep.
And meanwhile, again, you're moving Oaken's over to the AFI thing. And everyone I've spoken with that just kind of warns me that one may be temporary as well, because, again, they're still playing with what are the footprints of the stuff we're bringing in.
Yeah, the Oaken thing, I heard, the Frozen, so this is Oaken's...
Wandering Oaken's Emporium.
Right.
You know, again,
during the summer it was ice skating, but they're not going to do ice skating going forward. It's just snow.
Yep.
So they'll have fake snow, right? And then you can merchandise and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the interesting thing is they believe Oaken's is going to stay in its current position at least through when they move it over through January of next year.
So it's going to move from Soundstage 1, right?
Soundstage 1 over to this AFI facility.
Okay, so it's going to move up a little bit in the park. What's going to go in Soundstage 1?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. You know, this Soundstage 1 was where the Monsters, Inc. Scream coaster was supposed to go. In fact, you know, remember quite famously that somebody made the mistake, you know, the cast member portal. This is the way that Walt Disney cast members get information about what's going on at the parks. They can look at what their hours are. They can, you know, just this, it's these sort of kiosks within, they're all over Walt Disney World property, and you can go there and, you know, read your email and that sort of thing. Anyway, that quite famously back in 2008, one night at midnight, a file got loaded up that, you know, just this 2 minute long piece of video and about the Monsters, Inc. coaster, and showed concept art for it, said where it was going to go in Soundstage 1 at Disney's Hollywood Studios and all that, and it was up for 8 hours.
Until two people got into the building the next morning?
Well, yes. And it clearly what had happened was that somebody had uploaded something by accident that was supposed to go up later, or put in the wrong date. In meantime, between the time when it was leaked, the info was leaked, to the time that it was actually supposed to go forward, we had that horrible financial correction. You know, Wall Street melted down, and Disney put the project along with things like the first version of the redo of Pleasure Island, Edison Pier, Edison Wharf, whatever it was called.
Yeah.
You know, that got put on hold as well. So, you know, the thing is, like, if you're moving that out and you're looking to put a variety of different levels of Pixar-themed rides in, you've got this one designed. So that would appear to be what's going in there. But again, I have to preface this, that this is going to be – we're looking at a DCA-type redo. I mean, you're doing the front side of the park, or, you know, front to the left is – all this stuff for Star Wars Land, and to the back is all this stuff for Pixar, and we are looking at conservatively 2 to 3 years of construction.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just they will be opening pieces as they can open them, and, you know, and at the same time, they're trying to keep, to make sure that this will still be a workable, walkable park. You know, for example, for things like Star Wars weekends or the, you know, the Osborne Festival of Dancing Lights, which, by the way, that's supposedly the reason that Oaken's got moved to where it is. They believe that when they open the Osborne Festival of Musical Lights, you know, mm-hmm. in November,
yeah.
The traffic flow from people doing, sing-along in the old Premier Hunchback Theater to Oaken's, it's like, you know, this is all going to work, that, you know, just people will naturally come to the back of the park to see the Osborne lights. They'll do the sing-along, and they'll make sure there's signage, you know, that suggests, hey, if you want your Frozen merchandise, you go over there to Wandering Oaken's. So, so at least for a while through the holiday season, this makes sense from a retail point of view. Whether that Oaken's then stays in that place after January, especially given what they're thinking of spending and the way they're moving pieces around right now is kind of up in the air. I guess that's the other thing. You have to this is one of these things you're going to have to be patient with Disney on the announcement for this one, folks, because it is still very, very much in flux. And I won't lie to you, this summer, between what happened with Diagon Alley, and that really was a wake-up call for Disney in a lot of ways. Hmm. Because Disney has just been concerned about what happened since the first Harry Potter Hogsmeade opened. You know, since 2010, Universal went from 17% market share to 21-22% of you know, the market coming into Orlando.
Well,
And the worry is that Diagon Alley, 2 and 3 years from now, will constitute yet another 3 to 4 points of market share sliding. toward Universal. And I apologize, Len. I will tell you, give you details about this off air. But there's a third thing coming to Universal.
I know what it is.
Okay.
we won't talk about it though.
Yeah, but this is big.
Yeah.
And this will be at least day three.
Yeah, that's what okay. I think so too, yeah. That's why they're building the hotels.
No, that's exactly. Yeah, yeah. And once day three happens, the fear within Disney is that...
Well, yeah, because once you do that, then you're like, oh, well, you know, I can spend 3 days at Universal Orlando for half the price of Disney and just call it a vacation.
Yeah, yeah. but that would mean, in theory, that Universal could slip... You know, the numbers for Universal could move as high as 30% of the people coming into Orlando. And that, now, to be fair here, a lot of the market share that Universal has been able to grab hasn't necessarily all come from Disney. It's come from
SeaWorld's getting crushed. SeaWorld.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of the reasons why Legoland or the folks at Merlin are building the Orlando Eye, is to sort of, you know, sort of put a flag in the middle of the International Drive. And you know, you go to the Orlando Eye, you're going to pass a Legoland, you know, booth, you know, and they're going to play up.
There'll be plastic bricks thrown at you. Go see Legoland!
And not only that, that'll be the place in the morning. If you want to go to Legoland, they're going to provide transportation, I think, and for a nominal fee all the way out to.
Really?
I mean, that you can do a full day.
It really is a little bit of a hike out there.
Oh, God. It's, you know, I mean, this. And what's so funny is that when Disney first opened, people thought nothing of spending a day or two at Disneyland or Disney World, you know, see the Magic Kingdom, you know, drive on over, do Cypress Gardens, and then continue on over to Busch, you know, to do the Dark Continent. And now it's just sort of like, oh my God, it's, you know, drive all that way, you know, I'm staying here in my walled city.
Well, you know. the one thing is, though, I mean, the roads that you take from Disney to Legoland are a little more industrial.
Oh yeah.
Than I-4. I mean, at one point you're going down this road and it looks like, you know, a scene out of Louisiana backcountry from True Detective. You know, you're like, Matthew McConaughey pops up here, sweetie. We're just gonna keep driving. We're just gonna keep going.
Okay.
I see Woody Harrelson. Run!
Yeah, I can see the Legoland people love you, Len.
No, I like Legoland.
There's the pull quote for the, you know, there's the pull quote for the brochure. Just out of True Detective. You know, just sort of,
I like Legoland. I like Legoland everywhere. I think they have fun parks that are really great for the underage. But, you know, funny thing, you mentioned that for the studios. I really think that for under 6 year olds, six and unders, there's way more to do at Legoland than there is at the studios.
I know.
Way more to do.
Which is what this is all about. This is, in the end, folks, this is what you're seeing closing is, again, it's just wave goodbye to the studio. Because, again, that's one of the reasons why the name studio is coming off of that park. You know, because this is, we don't produce things here anymore. You get on rides, you go in restaurants. You know, just we're not going to pretend you actually, this is where you go to learn about Hollywood. Though, again, just to be fair here, this is a problem with everybody right now who's making a theme park. And there's a lot of them being built, you know, in Spain, in Dubai, you know, parks that celebrate the movies. Because, again, when you go to do an attraction about how a movie is made, it's like, it's done with a computer, the end. You know, I mean, it's just, there's no... You know, nobody's interested in how they did it in 1910.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's
You know, so again, this is the studios is going away, and get ready for an adventure. But honestly, the next 2 and 3 years is going to be an adventure just getting around this park from all the construction walls. But in the end, it'll be worth it. Just you know, just be ready for a somewhat sparse studio for a while like all this new cool stuff gets up out of the ground.
Real quick, Jim, did you hear anything about a third track being added to a Toy Story Mania?
You know, it's that story. When I've asked about it, it's just you get this Cheshire Cat-like grin, and there's two ways to interpret that. One is that it's actually happening, or the other is they are so enjoying the fan community having invented this thing that is now in the echo chamber of what the fan world thinks is going on at the parks. You know,
so you don't think that there's a third track going in for Star?
I think honestly, with the amount of money that's being spent on new Pixar related things, to spend money on expanding an attraction in that way. I mean, I know, Tim Grassi, is a big champion of this thing, and I love Tim. He's a great guy, but I just don't think. In the end, this makes any sense. You've got a pre-existing attraction. The only, I know, this tends to get grouped with the third theater for
Soarin',
which actually, in a way, makes sense.
I can see that. Yeah. Well.
But even there, it's one of these things where it's like, here's Tom Fitzgerald having just come through the door with the job of trying to revive and revitalize Epcot. And are you really going to spend money on an attraction, expanding a pre-existing attraction when, yes, there's a new ride film coming. There's Soarin' Around the World. It's going through the pipeline. It's being made for Shanghai and will come here. But is that really the smartest way to spend resources? And that's the new mantra coming out of WDI. I mean, it's just they're a very passionate, very confident group of guys right now. They've just, having just done, a Mystic Manor, and having just done the Ratatouille ride for Paris. These guys really, the level of confidence in this building I haven't seen in years. And they're really excited about. Nobody wants to talk more about what's going on Star Wars wise, and nobody wants to talk more about Pixar stuff than the Imagineers. Avatar is kind of a different situation. They've been having meetings about. They've just now kind of flashed on the fact that, we did say we were going to make mountains float. And it's like, well, that works as a CG model.
Excellent. Now all we have to do is build it.
Yeah. And it's just sort of like, it just because Joe Rohde wishes and hopes doesn't mean it's going to happen. So,
large magnets. Magnets. Yeah.
Oh, and speaking of which, I have you heard anything about the Bill and Ted's Halloween Adventure for Horror Nights this year?
No.
Okay.
Maybe I have, but I can't remember them.
Okay. Well, at one moment in the show, a gentleman runs on stage in a Navi outfit wearing a set of Mickey Mouse ears and basically says, God damn it, people really are going to love Avatar Land when it opens in 2075. I mean, mind you, that didn't get as big a laugh as the kind of hefty version of Elsa who came on stage, who, instead of, let it go, just talked about how she'd let herself go and she was addicted to snow cones.
That's funny.
They're aware of what people in the industry are saying about, Avatar Land, and, they're determined to wow us. But it just,
they've got 2.5 years.
So
it's essentially nothing. They've got no time.
Make with the wow.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, that's what's going on now, folks. And again, just all I can tell you is be patient with what they're going to do with the studio. When it's done, this will be, this will be the park that you don't blow off, face it, that's kind of the situation that's happening now with folks making really cool stuff off property. People are looking at the time they're spending at the Walt Disney World Resort and deciding, well, what day am I going to shave off of my time at Disney so I can go down the street and look at Diagon Alley? So, in response to that, it's like, okay, let's make this so cool. Let's make this so much, let's fill this park with so much stuff that the kids want to see, that they're not going to go down the street to Diagon Alley. And that's pretty much the battle plan, and honestly, you can thank Elsa and Anna for that. This summer, those crowds kind of opened the eyes at Disney, which is why you suddenly saw things like American Idol suddenly move from an early January close to an early September close.
Did we say January? We meant tomorrow.
That's right. That's right. And that's the thing that sort of shook everybody about the tram tour close. It's like, you know, no notice. It's like it goes, you know, and it's like, because we're serious. We got to get moving here, you know. So anyway, that's the news from Lake Wobegon, Len, you know.
Appreciate you. So. Hey, don't forget, if you guys like our stories, Jim and I will be in New York. October 26th, talking about Disney and the history of the World's Fair. Jim, I just recently read a whole bunch of stuff about the big attractions that Disney did at the World's Fair. It'll be great to discuss it with you.
Yeah, that's some funny stories with that project. But yeah, it's going to be a fun afternoon, folks.
Did you hear the one about the guy with the baseball bat that had to space out the cars and the... We hired some teamsters with baseball bats. No, it's not what you think. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, that's true, folks. And likewise, the railroad sightings that were used to prop up Small World. But you'll learn all about this at the event, folks.
October 26th, so. Go to etccustomevents.com and look at experiences for more information on it. We'll love to see you there. For Jim, this is Len. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go onto iTunes and rate our podcast. And let us know what you'd like to hear next. We definitely listen to your suggestions. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on the next show.
Take care, guys.